Ilium by Dan Simmons. Continuing on page 92. This was news. Homer had not sung of Aphrodite urging Pandarus to shoot Diomedes, only of Athena's earlier prompting of the archer to wound Menelaus so the war would resume. For Pandarus is literally a fool of the gods this day. His last day. Flesh wound for Diomedes, I say. Shoulder. Sthenelus was there and pulled it out. Evidently this arrow wasn't poisoned. Athena QT'd into the fray a minute ago, took her pet Diomedes aside, and put energy into his limbs, his feet, and his fighting hands. Knightenhelzer was quoting some translation of Homer that I'm not familiar with. More nanotech, I say. Has Diomedes found the archer and killed him yet? About 5 minutes ago. Did Pandarus give that endless speech before Diomedes killed him? I ask. In my favorite translation, Pandarus bemoans his fate for 40 lines, has a long dialogue with a Trojan captain named Aeneas. Yes, the Aeneas. And the two go charging at Diomedes in a chariot, flinging spears at the wounded Achaean. No, says Knightenhelzer. Pandarus just said, fuck me, when the arrow missed its mark. Then he leaped on the chariot with Aeneas, tossed a spear that went right through Diomedes' shield and breastplate, but missed flesh and said shit in the second before Diomedes' spear caught him right between the eyes. Another case, I presume, of Homer's poetic license in all the speech-making. And Aeneas? That encounter is crucial to history as well as the Iliad. I can't believe I missed it. Aphrodite saved him just a minute ago, confirms Knightenhelzer. Aeneas is the mortal son of the goddess of love, and she watches over him carefully. Diomedes smashed Aeneas' hip bone to bits with a boulder, just as in the poem, but Aphrodite protected her wounded boy with a force field and is carrying him off the field now. It really pissed Diomedes off. I shield my eyes with my hand. Where's Diomedes now? But I see the Greek warrior before Knightenhelzer can point him out, about 100 yards away in the center of a melee far behind Trojan lines. There is a mist of blood in the air around shining Diomedes and a heap of corpses on each side of the slashing, hacking, stabbing Achaean. The augmented Diomedes appears to be hacking his way through waves of human flesh to catch up to the slowly retreating Aphrodite. Jesus, I say softly. Yeah, says the other Skolic. In the last few minutes he's killed Astynous and Hyperon, Abbas and Pelias, Xanthus and Thoon, Achaemon and Chromius, all the captain pairs. Why in twos, I ask, thinking aloud. Knightenhelzer looks at me as if I'm a slow student in one of his freshman classes. They were in chariots, Hockenberry. 2 men per chariot. Diomedes killed them all as the chariots came at him. Ah, I say, embarrassed now. My attention isn't on the murdered Trojan captains, but on Aphrodite. The goddess has just paused in her retreat from the Trojan lines, still carrying the wounded Aeneas, and is now strutting to and fro, clearly visible to the milling and frightened Trojans fleeing Diomedes' attack. Aphrodite is forcing the Trojan fighters back toward the fray with stabs of electricity and shimmering force-field shoves. Diomedes sees the goddess and goes berserk, hacking his way through a final protective line of Trojans to confront the goddess herself. He does not speak, but readies his long spear. Aphrodite raises a force field almost casually, still carrying the wounded Aeneas, obviously not worried by a mere mortal's attack. She has forgotten Athena's modifications of Diomedes. Diomedes leaps forward. The goddess's force field crackles and gives way. The Achaean lunges with his long spear, and the shaft and barb of it tear through Aphrodite's personal force field, silken robes, and divine flesh. The razor-sharp spear point slashes the goddess's wrist so that red muscle and white bone show. Golden ichor, rather than red blood, sprays into the air. Aphrodite stares at the wound for a second and then screams, an inhuman scream, something huge and amplified, a female roar out of a bank of amplifiers at a rock concert from hell. She reels, still screaming, and drops Aeneas. Rather than press home his successful attack on Aphrodite, Diomedes unsheathes his sword and prepares to decapitate the unconscious Aeneas. Phoebus Apollo, Lord of the Silver Bow, QTs into solidity between the berserk Diomedes and the fallen Trojan, and holds the Achaean at bay with a pulsing hemisphere of plasma force field. Blinded by bloodlust, Diomedes hacks away at the force field, his own energy field crashing red against Apollo's defensive yellow shield. Aphrodite is still staring at her mangled wrist, and it looks as if she may swoon and lie there helpless in front of the still raging Diomedes. The goddess seems unable to concentrate enough to QT while in such pain. Suddenly her brother Ares arrives in a blazing flying chariot, shoving aside Trojans and Greeks alike, as he widens the ship's plasma footprint to land by his sister. Aphrodite is blubbering and wailing in pain, trying to explain that Diomedes has gone mad. "He'd fight Father Zeus," screams the goddess, collapsing in the war god's arms. "Can you fly this?" demands Ares. "No." Aphrodite does swoon now. She falls into Ares' arms, still cradling the injured left hand and wrist in her bloody or Ikorish right hand. It is strangely disturbing to watch. Gods and goddesses don't bleed, at least not in my 9 years here. The goddess Iris, Zeus's personal messenger, flicks onto the battlefield between the chariot and Apollo's force field where the god still protects the fallen Aeneas. The Trojans have backed away now. Eyes bugging, and Diomedes is being held at bay by the overlapped energy fields. The Achaean is radiating heat and fury in the infrared, looking all the world like a warrior made out of pulsing lava. "Take her to her mother," commands Ares, laying the unconscious Aphrodite on the floor of the chariot. Iris lifts the energy craft skyward and phase shifts it out of sight. "Amazing," says Knight and Helzer. "Fan-fucking-tastic," I say. It is the first time in my more than 9 years here that I have seen a Greek or Trojan successfully attack a god. I turn to see Knightenhauser staring at me in shock. I forget sometimes that the Skoldic is from a previous decade. "Well, it is," I say defensively. I want to follow Aphrodite to Olympus and see what happens between her and Zeus. Homer had written about it, of course, but there already has been enough disparity between the poem and real events here today to pique my interest. I begin edging away from Knightenhauser, who is watching events so raptly that he does not notice my departure, and ready myself to don the Hades helmet and twist the personal QT medallion's controls. But something is happening on the battlefield. Diomedes lets out a war cry almost as loud as Aphrodite's still-echoing scream of pain, and then the augmented Achaean charges Aeneas and Apollo again. This time, Diomedes' nano-strengthened body and phase-shifted sword hack through Apollo's outer layers of energy shield. The god stands motionless as Diomedes hacks and cuts his way through the shimmering force field, like a man shoveling invisible snow. Then Apollo's voice rings out with amplification that must be audible 2 or 3 miles away. "Think, Diomedes, back off! Enough of this mortal insanity, warring with the gods! We're not of the same breed, human. We never were. We never will be." Apollo grows in size from his imposing 8 feet of stature to become a giant more than 20 feet tall. Diomedes halts his attack and backs away, although it is impossible to tell whether it is out of temporary fear or sheer exhaustion. Apollo bends down and opaques the force fields around him and the fallen Aeneas. When the black fog disappear a minute later, the god is gone, but Aeneas is still lying there, wounded, hip-shattered, bleeding. The Trojan fighters rush to form a circle around their fallen and abandoned leader before Diomedes slaughters him. It is not Aeneas. I know that Apollo has left a tensile hologram behind and carried the real wounded prince to the heights of Pergamus, Ilium's citadel, where the goddess Leto and Artemis, Ares' sister, will use their nanotech god medicine to save Aeneas' life and mend his wounds in minutes. I'm ready to flick away to Olympus when suddenly Apollo QTs back to the battlefield, shielded from mortal view. Ares, still rallying Trojans behind his defensive shield, looks up when the other god arrives. "Ares, destroyer of men, you stormer of ramparts, are you going to let that piece of dog shit insult you like that?" Invisible to the Achaeans, Apollo is pointing at the panting and recovering Diomedes. "Insult me? How has he insulted me?" "You idiot," thunders Apollo in ultrasonic frequencies audible only to the gods and Skoliks and the dogs in Troy, who set up a fearsome howling in response. That mortal has just assaulted the goddess of love, your sister, slashing the tendons of her immortal wrist. Diomedes even charged me, one of the most powerful of the gods. Athena has made him into something superhuman to make Ares, war god reeking of blood into a laughing stock. Ares' head swivels back toward the panting Diomedes, who has been ignoring the god since his attempt to cut through the force fields failed. "He makes fun of me?" screams Ares in a shout everyone from here to Olympus can hear. I've noted over the years that Ares is rather stupid for a god. He's proving it today. "He dares make jest of me?" "Kill him," cries Apollo, still speaking in the ultrasonic. "Cut out his heart and eat it." And the god of the silver bow QTs away. Ares is going crazy. I decide I can't leave yet. I desperately want a QT to Olympus and see how badly injured Aphrodite is, but this is just too interesting to miss. First, the war god morphs into the runner Acamas, prince of Thrace, and runs to and from among the milling Trojans, urging them back into the battle to push the Greeks out of the salient they have created following Diomedes into the Trojan lines. Then Ares morphs into the form of Sarpedon and taunts Hector, the hero is holding back from the fight with rare reticence. Shamed by what he thinks are Sarpedon's accusations, Hector rejoins his men. When Ares sees that Hector is rallying the main body of Trojan fighters, the god becomes himself and joins the circle of fighters holding the Greeks away from the hologram of unconscious Aeneas. I confess, I've never seen fighting this fierce during my 9 years here. If Homer taught us anything, it is that the human being is a frail vessel, a fleshly flagon of blood and loose guts just waiting to be spilled. They're spilling now. The Achaeans don't wait for Ares to get his second wind, but rush in with chariot and spear behind the wild leadership of Diomedes and Odysseus. Horses scream, chariots splinter and tumble, horsemen drive their steeds into a wall of spear points and gleaming shields. Diomedes flames to the front again, calling his men forward even while he kills every Trojan who comes within his reach. Apollo flicks back to the battlefield in a swirl of purple mist and releases the healed Aeneas, the real Aeneas, into the fray. The young man has been healed and more. He flows with light the way modified Diomedes did when Athena had finished with him. The Trojans, already rallying behind Hector, let out a massed yell at the sight of their resurrected prince and launch their counterattack. Now it is Aeneas and Diomedes leading the fighting on opposite sides of the line, killing enemy captains by the bucketful, while Apollo and Ares urge more Trojans into the fray. I watch as Aeneas slaughters the carefree Achaean twins, Orsilochus and Creton. Now Menelaus, recovered from his own wound, shoves past Odysseus and rushes toward Aeneas. I hear Ares laugh. The war god would love it if Agamemnon's brother, Helen's real husband, the man who started this war by mislaying his wife, was cut down dead this day. Aeneas and Menelaus come within arm's reach of each other, the other fighters backing away in respect for Aristaeus. The two warriors' spears thrusting and fainting, thrusting and fainting. Suddenly, Nestor's brother, Antilochus, good friend to the all-but-forgotten Achilles, leaps forward to stand shoulder to shoulder with Menelaus, obviously afraid the Greek cause will die with their captain if he does not intervene. Confronted with two legendary killers rather than one, Aeneas backs away. 200 yards east of this confrontation, Hector has waded into the Achaean line with such ferocity that even Diomedes falls back with his men. With his augmented vision, Diomedes must see Ares, invisible to the others, fighting at Hector's side. I still want to leave to check on Aphrodite, but I can't tear myself away right now. I can see Neitenhalser madly taking notes on his recorder Ansible. This makes me laugh, since the thousands of noble Trojans and Argives battling here are all as preliterate as 2-year-olds. If they found Neitenhalser's scribblings even in Greek, they would mean nothing to these men. All the gods are getting into the act now. Hera and Athena blink back into existence. Zeus's wife visibly urging Athena into the fight. Athena does not resist. Hebe, the goddess of youth and servant to the older gods, flashes down in a flying chariot. Hera takes control, and Athena also leaps aboard, dropping her robe while buckling on her breastplate. Athena's battle shirt gleams. She lifts a crackling energy shield of bright yellow and pulsing red, and her sword sends bolts of lightning to the earth. "Look!" It's Neitenhalser shouting to me above the fray. There's real lightning coming from the north, a towering bank of dark stratocumulus rising 40,000 feet or higher into the hot afternoon sky. the cloud suddenly shapes itself into the form and visage of Zeus. "Leap to it, then, wife and daughter," roars the thunder from that storm. "Athena, see if you're the war god's match. Bring him down if you can." Black clouds roil low over the battlefield while rain and lightning strike down at Trojan and Argive alike. Hera brings the chariot low over the heads of the Greeks, then lower still, scattering Trojans like leather and bronze tenpins. Athena leaps down into a real chariot next to exhausted, blood-encrusted Diomedes and his faithful driver, Sthenelus. "Are you done for this day, mortal?" she screams at Diomedes, the last word dripping sarcasm. "Are you half the size of your father to stop when your opponents hold the field so?" She gestures to where Hector and Ares are sweeping the Greeks back before their charge. "Goddess," Diomedes gasps, "the immortal Ares protects Hector, and..." "Do I not protect you?" roars Athena, 15 feet tall and growing, looming over the fading glow of Diomedes. "Yes, goddess, but..." "Diomedes, joy of my heart, cut down that Trojan and the god who protects him." Diomedes looks startled, even horrified. "We mortals may not kill a god. Where is that written?" Booms Athena and leans over Diomedes, injecting him with something new, pouring energy from her personal god field to his. The goddess grabs the hapless Sthenelus and throws him 30 feet from the chariot. Athena takes the reins of Diomedes' chariot and whips the horses forward, straight toward Hector and Ares and the entire Trojan army. Diomedes readies his spear as if he fully plans to kill a god, to slay Ares. "And Aphrodite wants to use me to kill Athena herself," I think, heart pounding with the terror and excitement of the moment. Things may soon be going quite differently than Homer predicted here on the plains of Troy. 12. Above the asteroid belt. The ship began decelerating almost as soon as it left the Jovian magnetosphere, so their great ballistic arc above the plane of the ecliptic to Mars on the far side of the sun would take several standard days rather than hours. This was good for Monmut and Orfu of Io, since they had a lot to discuss. Soon after their departure, Repo and Chorus III in the forward control module announced that they were deploying the Boron sail. Monmut watched through ship's sensors as the circular sail was unfolded and trailed 7 kilometers behind them on 8 bucky cables, then deployed to its full radius of 5 kilometers. It looked like a black circle cut out of the star field to Monmut as he watched the stern video feed. Orfu of Io left his hull crash and scuttled down the main cable, along the solenoid torus, and then out along the support cables like a horseshoe crab Quasimodo, testing everything, tugging everything, scooting on reaction jets above the sail surface to check for cracks or seams or imperfections. He found nothing wrong and shuttled back to the ship with a strange and imperious zero-gravity grace. Chorus III ordered the modified Matlow-Fennelly magnetic scoop fired up, and Monmut felt and recorded the ship's energies changing as the device on the prow of their ship generated a scoop field radius of 1,400 kilometers, shoveling in loose ions and concentrating on gathering up the solar wind. "How long is this going to take to decelerate us enough to be able to stop at Mars?" asked Monmut on the common line, thinking that Orfu would answer. It was the imperious Chorus III who responded. "As ship velocity decreases and the effective area of the scoop increases, always keeping sail temperature from exceeding its melting point of 2,000 degrees Kelvin, ship mass will equal 4 × 10⁶, and therefore deceleration from our current velocity of 0.1992 c to 0.001 c, the inelastic collision point, will require 23.6 standard years." 23.6 standard years, cried Monmut over the common line. That was more discussion time than he had bargained for. "That would slow us only to a still sizable velocity of 300 kilometers per second," said Chorus III. 1,000th light speed is nothing to sneeze at where we're going in system." "Sounds like it's going to be a hard landing on Mars," said Monmut. Orfu made a rumbling, sneezing sound on the line. The Callista navigator came online. We're not going to depend only upon the ion-boron sail deceleration, Monmouth. The actual trip will take a little under 11 standard days, and our velocity upon entering Mars orbit will be less than 6 kilometers per second. That's better, said Monmouth. He was in the control cradle of the Dark Lady, but all his familiar sensors and controls were dark. It was strange to be picking up all data other than his own life support from the larger ship's sensors. What makes the difference?
The solar wind, said Orfu through the hull crash hardline. It averages about 300 kilometers per second out here, and has an ion density of 10 to the 6th protons over M to the 3rd power. We started with a half tank of Jovian hydrogen and a quarter tank of deuterium. And we're going to strip more hydrogen and deuterium from the solar wind with the Matlow-Fennelly scoop and fire the 4 fusion engines on the bow just after passing the sun. That's where the real deceleration is going to kick in.
I can't wait, said Monmouth.
Me too, said Orfu of Io.
He made the rumbling, sneezing sound again. Monmouth thought that the huge Moravec had either no sense of irony or a wickedly sharp one. Monmouth read, A la recherche du temps perdu, Proust's In Search of Lost Time, while the ship passed some 140 million kilometers above the asteroid belt. Orfu had downloaded the French language in all of its classic intricacies along with the novel and biographical information on Proust. But Monmouth ended up reading the book in 5 English translations because English was the lost language he had concentrated his own studies in over the past century and a half, and he felt more comfortable judging literature in it. Orfu had chuckled at this and reminded the smaller Moravec that comparing Proust to Monmouth's beloved Shakespeare was a mistake. But they were as different in substance as the rocky, terraformed in-system world they were headed for and their own familiar Jovian moons. But Monmouth read it again in English anyway. When he was finished, knowing that it had been a cursory multiple reading, but eager to start the dialogue, he contacted Orfu on tight beam since the Ionian Moravec was out of his crash, checking the boron sail cables again, lashed firmly to lifelines this time because of the increasing deceleration. I don't know, said Monmouth. I just don't see it. It all seems like the overwrought musings of an aesthete to me.
Aesthete?
Orfu swiveled one of his communication stalks to lock in the tight beam while his manipulators and flagella were busy spot-welding a cable connector. To Monmouth, watching on rear video, the white welding arc looked like a star against the black sail behind the awkward mass of Orfu.
Monmouth, are you talking about Proust or his Marcel narrator?
Is there a difference? Even as he sent the sarcastic query, Monmouth knew he was being unfair. He had sent Orfu hundreds, perhaps thousands, of emails over the last 12 years, explaining the difference between the poet named Will in the sonnets and the historical artist named Shakespeare. He suspected the Proust, however dense and impenetrable, to be just as complex when it came to identity of author and characters.
Orfu of Io ignored that question and sent back, Admit that you loved Proust's comic vision. He is, above almost all else, a comic writer.
Was there a comic vision? I saw little comedy in the work. Monmouth was serious about this. It was not that the human sense of humor was alien to Monmouth or Moravec. Even the earliest spacefaring, self-evolving, only dimly sentient robots created and dispatched by the human race before the Rubicon pandemic had been programmed to understand humor. Communication with human beings, real two-way communication, had been impossible without humor. It was as human as anger or logic or jealousy or pride. All elements he had noticed and noted in Proust's endless novel. But Proust and his protagonists as comic writers, comic characters? Monmouth failed to see it, and if Orfu were right, it was a major oversight. It had been Monmouth who spent decades on finding the wordplay, humor, and satire in the bard's plays. Monmouth who had ferreted out even the tiniest ironies in Shakespeare's sonnets.
Listen, said Orfu, as he scuttled back along one of the taut bucky lines to the ship, reaction jets pulsing. Read this part of Swan in Love again. This is where Swan, enthralled to the faithless and fickle Odetta, is using all his skill as an emotional blackmailer to keep her from going to the theater without him. Listen to the humor here, my friend. A downloaded text.
I swear to you, he told her shortly before she was to leave for the theater, that in asking you not to go, I should hope, were I a selfish man, for nothing so much as that you should refuse. For I have 1,000 other things to do this evening, and I shall feel trapped myself and rather annoyed if, after all, you tell me you're not going. But my occupations, my pleasures are not everything. I must think of you also. A day may come when, seeing me irrevocably sundered from you, you will be entitled to reproach me for not having warned you at the decisive hour in which I felt that I was about to pass judgment on you. One of those stern judgments which love cannot long resist. You see, your nuit de clair-page, what a title, has no bearing on the point. What I must know is whether you are indeed one of those creatures in the lowest grade of mentality and even of charm, one of those contemptible creatures who are incapable of foregoing a pleasure. And if you are such, how could anyone love you, for you are not even a person, a clearly defined entity, imperfect but at least perfectible. You are a formless water that will trickle down any slope that offers itself, a fish devoid of memory, incapable of thought, which all its life long in its aquarium will continue to dash itself 100 times a day against the glass wall, always mistaking it for water. Do you realize that your answer will have the effect, I won't say of making me cease loving you immediately, of course, but of making you less attractive in my eyes when I realize that you are not a person, that you are beneath everything in the world and incapable of raising yourself 1 inch higher? Obviously, I should have preferred to ask you as a matter of little or no importance to give up your nuit de clair-page, since you compel me to sully my lips with so abject a name, in the hope that you would go to it nonetheless. But having decided to make such an issue of it, to draw such drastic consequences from your reply, I confessed it more honorable to give you due warning. Meanwhile, Odette had shown signs of increasing emotion and uncertainty. Although the meaning of his tirade was beyond her, she grasped that it was to be included in the catalogue of harangues and scenes of reproach or supplication, which her familiarity with the ways of men enabled her, without paying any heed to the words that were uttered, to conclude that they would not make unless they were in love, and that since they were in love, it was unnecessary to obey them, as they would only be more in love later on. And so she would have heard Swan out with the utmost tranquility had she not noticed that it was growing late, and that if he went on talking much longer, she would never, as she told him with a fond smile, obstinate but slightly abashed, get there in time for the overture. Manmut laughed out loud in the tight confines of the dark lady's pressurized control room. He saw it now. The humor was brilliant. He had read that passage the first time, focusing on the human emotion of jealousy and the obvious effort of the Swan character to manipulate the behavior of the woman named Odette. Now it was clear. Thanks, he said to Orfu as the 6-meter horseshoe crab-shaped Moravec settled into his hull crash. I think I hear the humor coming through now. I appreciate it. Everything is different than Shakespeare's tone and language and structure, but something is the same.
Obsession with the puzzle of what it means to be human, suggested Orfu. Your Shakespeare looks at all the facets of humanity through reaction to events, finding the deep internal through characters defined as actions. Proust's characters delve deep into memory to see the same facets. Perhaps your bard is more like Chorus 3, leading this outward expedition. My sweet Proust is more like you, wrapped in the cocoon of the Dark Lady and diving deep, seeking the geography of reefs and the hard bottom and other living things and the whole world through echolocation.
Manmut thought about this for several rich nanoseconds. I don't see how your Proust solved this puzzle, or rather how he tried to solve it, other than through immersion in memory.
Not just in memory, Manmut, my friend, but in time.
Tens of meters away, shielded by his near invulnerable and impenetrable double hull of his submersible and that of the ship carrying it, Mahmud felt as if the Ionian had reached out and touched him in some personal, some profound manner. "Time is separate from memory," muttered Mahmud on their private line, speaking now mostly to himself. "But is memory ever separate from time?"
"Precisely," boomed Orfu. "Precisely. Proust's protagonist, primarily the I, or Marcel narrator, but also our poor swan, have three chances to snip out and put together the thick puzzle of life. Their three approaches fail, but somehow the story itself succeeds, despite its narrator's and even author's failures."
Mahmud thought about this for a time in silence. He switched his vision from external camera to external camera, looking away at the complexities of the ship itself and its frightening circular sail downward toward the rocks, toward the belt. He wheeled the image to full magnification, and there it was. A solitary asteroid was tumbling against black. There was no danger of impact. Not only was their ship now 150 million kilometers above the plane of the ecliptic and passing the belt at blinding speed, but this asteroid... He queried Repo's astrogation banks and identified the rock as Gaspra. Was tumbling away from them. Still, it was a sizable mini-world. The overlay data said that Gaspra sized out at 20 by 16 by 11 kilometers, and the magnification, equal to a pass at about 16,000 kilometers, showed an irregular, sharpened potato mass with a complicated pattern of cratering. More interestingly, there were obvious artificial elements in the image. Straight lines gouged in the rock, gleams of light in dark craters, clear patterns of light sources on the asteroid's flattened nose.
"Rock Vex," Orfu said softly. He was obviously looking at the same video source. "There are a few million scattered around the belt."
"Are they as hostile as everyone says?"
As soon as he sent his question, Mahmud was afraid it would type him as anxious.
"I don't know. My guess is that they are. They chose to evolve in a much more competitive culture than we created. Word is that they fear and loathe post-humans, and flatly hate us outlying Moravex. Koros III might know if the legend of their ferocity are true."
"Koros? Why would he know?"
"Not many Moravex know it, but he led an expedition to the rocks about 60 E-years ago for Astig Che and the Five Moons Consortium. 9 Moravex went with him. Only 3 others returned."
Mahmud pondered this for a minute. He wished he knew more about weapons. If the Rock Vex wanted to kill them now, did they possess an energy weapon or a hyperkinetic missile that could catch this ship? It seemed unlikely, not at their current velocity of more than 0.193 light speed. Mahmud said to Orfu, "What are the three ways Proust's characters tried to solve the puzzle of life and failed?" The big deep space Moravec cleared his virtual throat.
"First, they followed their noses down the scent trail to nobility, title, birthright, and the landed gentry," said Orfu. "Marcel, the narrator, tries this route for 2,000 pages or so. At least he believes that in the more important aristocracy lies nobility of character. But it all comes up empty."
"Just snobbery," says Mahmud.
"Never just snobbery, my friend," says Orfu, his booming voice growing more animated over their private line. "Proust saw snobbery as the glue that holds society, any society in any age, together. He studies it on all levels throughout the book. He never tires of its manifestations."
"I did," Mahmud said quietly, hoping that his honesty wouldn't offend his friend. Orfu's rumble vibrating in the subsonic even on the line assured Mahmud that he hadn't. "What was the second path he tried to follow to the answer of the puzzle of life?" asked Mahmud.
"Love," said Orfu.
"Love?" repeated Mahmud. There had been plenty of it in the more than 3,000 pages of In Search of Lost Time, but it had all seemed so hopeless.
"Love," boomed Orfu. "Sentimental love and physical lust."
"You mean the sentimental love that Marcel and Swan, I guess, felt for their family, Marcel's grandmother?"
"No, Mahmud. The sentimental attraction to familiar things, to memory itself, and to the people who fall into the realm of familiar things.
Monmouth glanced at the tumbling asteroid called Gaspra. According to reposed data bar, it took Gaspra about 7 standard hours to revolve completely around his axis. Monmouth wondered if such a place could ever be a source of familiarity, of sentimental attraction to him, to any sentient being.
Well, the dark seas of Europa are...
Pardon? Monmouth felt his organic layers prickle when he realized he had spoken aloud on the private line. Nothing. Why didn't love lead to the answer to the puzzle of life?
Because Proust knew, and his characters discover, that neither love nor its more noble cousin friendship ever survived the entropy blades of jealousy, boredom, familiarity, and egotism, said Orfu.
And for the first time in their direct communication, Monmouth fancied that he heard a tone of sadness in the big Moravec's voice. Never?
Never, said Orfu, and rumbled a deep sigh. Remember the last lines of Swan in Love? To think that I wasted years of my life, that I hoped to die, that I had my greatest love affair with a woman who didn't appeal to me, who wasn't even my type.
I noted that, said Monmouth, but I didn't know at the time if it was supposed to be terribly funny or horribly bitter or unspeakably sad. Which was it?
All three, my friend, said Orfu of Io. All three.
What was Proust's character's third path to the puzzle of life? Asked Monmouth. He increased the O2 input to his chamber to clear away the cobweb tendrils of sadness that were threatening to gather in his heart.
Let's save that for another time, said Orfu, perhaps sensing his interlocutor's mood. Chorus 3 is going to increase the scoop radius, and it might be fun to watch the fireworks on the X-ray spectra.
They passed Mars's orbit, and there was nothing to see. Mars, of course, was on the opposite side of the sun. They passed Earth's orbit a day later, and there was nothing to see. Earth was far around the curve of its orbit on the plane of the ecliptic far below. Mercury was the only planet clearly visible on the monitors as they flashed above it, but by then the roar and blaze of the sun itself filled all their viewing screens. As they passed over the sun at a perihelion of only 97 million kilometers, radiator filaments trailing heat, the boron sail was collapsed, reeled in, and folded into its aft dome. Orfu helped the remote handlers with the job, and Monmouth watched on the ship's screens as his friend shuttled to and fro, his surface scars and pitting quite visible in the blazing sunlight. 2 hours before they were scheduled to fire the fusion engines, Koros 3 surprised Monmouth by inviting everyone to gather at the control room module near the magnetic scoop horns. There were no internal corridors in the ship. The plan had been for Koros to transfer to the Dark Lady via cables and grab holds once the ship was finished decelerating and in Martian orbit. Monmouth was dubious about making the trip across the hull now to the control room. Why should we physically gather to talk, he asked Orfu on their private line. And you can't fit in the control room module anyway.
I can hover outside, view all of you through the port, connect hard lines to the control module for a secure communication.
Why is that better than conferencing on the all-call?
I don't know, said Orfu. But we fire the engines in 114 minutes, so why don't I shuttle around the ship's hold and pick you up?
That's what they did. Monmouth had no problem with vacuum and hard radiation, of course, but the thought of disconnecting from the ship and somehow being left behind had rattled him. Orfu met him at the cargo bay, and Monmouth had an unforgettable glimpse of the Dark Lady, starkly illuminated by the sun's blinding rays, tucked in the spacecraft's hold like a salt shark in a kraken's belly. Orfu used his manipulators to place Monmouth in a sheltered niche in the Ionian's carapace and clipped onto guidelines for the reaction jet trip around the dark belly of the ship, up its girded and torused ribs, and forward along the upper hull. Monmouth glanced at the spherical fusion engines, clipped onto the prow-like design afterthoughts, and checked the time, 1 hour and 4 minutes until ignition. Monmouth studied the ultra-stealth material enclosing the ship proper. Dead black and porous baffle wrap that made the ship, minus its fusion engines, boron sail, and other expendables theoretically invisible to sight, radar, deep radar, gravitonic reflection, infrared, UV, and neutrino probes. But what difference does that make if we go in on four pillars of fusion flame for 2 days? The control room had an airlock. Monmouth helped Orfu connect his shielded hardline, and then he cycled through the lock and resumed breathing air the old-fashioned way. "This ship is carrying weapons," said Koraz III without preamble. He spoke the words through the air. His multifaceted eyes and black humanoid shell reflected the red halogen lights. The third Moravec in the small pressurized control room, the tiny Callistan Repo, situated himself at the third point of the Moravec triangle. "Are you hearing this?" subvocalized Monmouth on his private line to Orfu. The huge Ionian was visible outside the forward windows.
"Oh, yes."
"Why are you telling us now?" Monmouth asked Koraz III. "I thought you and the Ionian had a right to know. Your existences are at stake here." Monmouth looked at the navigator. "You knew about the weapons?"
"I knew about the defense weaponry built into the ship," replied Repo. "I didn't know until now that there would be weapons brought to the surface, but it was a logical assumption."
"To the surface," repeated Monmouth. "There are weapons in the Dark Lady's hold." It was not really a question. Koraz III nodded in that age-old humanoid signal of confirmation.
"What kind?" demanded Monmouth.
"I'm not at liberty to say," the tall Ganymedan said stiffly.
"Well, perhaps I'm not at liberty to transport weapons in my submersible," snapped Monmouth.
"You have no choice in the matter," said Koraz III. His voice sounded more sad than imperious. Monmouth seethed.
"He's right," said Orfu, and Monmouth realized that the Ionian had spoken on the common line. "None of us have any choice at this point. We have to go ahead."
"Then why tell us?" Monmouth demanded again. It was Repo who responded. "We've been monitoring Mars since we came over the sun. From this distance, our instruments confirm the quantum activity detected from Jovian space. But the intensity is several magnitudes greater than we estimated. This world is a threat to the entire solar system."
"How so?"
asked Orfu.
"The post-humans experimented quantum shifting for centuries in their orbital cities around Earth."
Koraz III shook his head in that quaint, human-like way, although quaint was not a word that came to Monmouth's mind when he stared at the tall, shiny black figure with his gleaming fly's eyes.
"Nothing to this extent," said their mission leader. "The amount of quantum phase shifting occurring on Mars right now amounts to a hole torn in the fabric of space-time. It's not stable. It's not a sane exercise of quantum technology."
"Does it have something to do with the Voynix?" asked Orfu.
"All most Jovian Moraveks knew of the fabled Voynix was that the planet Earth had radiated unprecedented quantum phase shift activity when the creatures had first been mentioned in monitored post-human neutrino communications more than 2,000 E-years earlier. We don't know if the Voynix are involved or indeed if they are still on Earth," Koraz sent on the common band. "I'll repeat that I felt it ethically imperative to inform all of you that there are weapons aboard this ship and aboard the submersible on which Monmouth will be transporting me. The decisions to use these weapons will not be yours. The responsibility lies solely with me when I'm aboard this ship, and with Repo for ship defense when Monmouth and I have dropped to the planet's surface. The decision to use deadly force on Mars itself will be mine alone."
"The ship's weapons are not offensive, then, not to be used against targets on Mars?" asked Monmouth.
"No," said Repo. "The shipboard weapons are defensive only."
"But the weapons aboard the Dark Lady include weapons of mass destruction?" asked Orfu of Io.
Koraz III paused, obviously weighing his orders against the crew's right to know. Finally, he said, "Yes." Monmouth tried to decide what these weapons of mass destruction might be. Fission bombs, fusion weapons, neutrino emitters, plasma explosives, antimatter devices, planet-busting black hole bombs. He had no idea. His centuries of existence gave him no experience with weapons outside those non-lethal nets. Prods and galvanizers needed to ward off Kraken or capture Europan sea life.
Corus, he asked softly, did you bring weapons on your mission to the rocks some decades ago?
No, said the Ganymedan. There was no need. However warlike and ferocious the asteroid Moravex of the existence of all sentient beings in the solar system.
Corus III projected the time. They had 41 minutes until the fusion engines fired.
Any other questions?
Orfu had one.
Why are we wrapped in ultra-stealth if we're approaching Mars behind four fusion trails that will light us up like a supernova, visible day and night for Sols to anything with eyes on the Martian surface?
Wait. You're trying to get a response. Trying to make them attack us.
Yes, said Corus. It was the easiest way to assess their intentions. The fusion engines will shut off while we are still 18 million kilometers from Mars. If they have not attempted to intercept us by then, we will jettison the engines, the solenoid toruses, and all other external devices, and enter Martian orbit with passive countermeasures hiding our location. Currently, we do not know if the post-humans or whatever entities have terraformed Mars and are currently residing there have a technical or post-technical civilization. Manmut considered this. They would be jettisoning every form of propulsion that could get them home.
I would say that massive quantum phase shift activity is a sign of something pretty technological, said Orfu.
Perhaps, said Repo, but there are idiot savants in the universe.
With that cryptic statement, the meeting ended. Atmosphere was drained out of the control room, and Orfu hauled Manmut back to his submersible in the ship's hold. The four engines fired on cue. For the next 2 days, Manmut was pinned to his high-G couch as the ship decelerated down onto the plane of the ecliptic toward Mars at more than 400 Gs. The hold around the Dark Lady was again filled with high-G gel, but his living compartment wasn't, and the weight and lack of mobility grew tiring to Manmut. He couldn't imagine the stress on Orfu out in his hull cradle. Mars and all forward images were obscured by the four-sun glare of the engines, but Manmut passed the time by checking on video of the hull, the stars astern, and by re-reading parts of A la recherche du temps perdu, and finding connections and disparities with his beloved Shakespearean sonnets. Manmut's and Orfu's love of lost-age human languages and literature was not all that unusual. More than 2,000 years earlier, the first Moravex to be sent out to Jovian space to explore the moons and to contact the sentients known to be in the atmosphere of Jupiter were programmed by the first post-humans with elaborate full-sensory tapes of human history, human culture, and the human arts. The Rubicon had already occurred, of course, and before that the Great Retreat, but there had still been some hope of saving the memory and records of the human past, even if the last 9,114 old-style humans on Earth could not be saved by the final facts. In the centuries since contact had been lost with Earth, human art and human literature and human history had become the hobbies of thousands of the hardback and moon-based Moravex. Manmut's former partner, Ertzweil, who had been destroyed in an icefall under the European ice crater of Tyre Macula 18 J years before, had been passionate about the King James Bible. A copy of that Bible still sat in the cubby under Manmut's stowed work table, next to the gel-insulated lava lamp Ertzweil had given his partner as a gift. Watching the filter-dimmed flare of the forward fusion engines on his video monitor, Manmut tried to connect his image of the historical Marcel Proust, a man who took to his bed for the last 3 years of his life in his famous cork-lined room, surrounded by his always-arriving galley proofs, old manuscripts and bottles of addictive potions, visited only by the occasional male prostitute and workers putting in one of the first opera-delivering telephones in Paris, with the Marcel narrator of the exhausting work of perception that was In Search of Lost Time. Manmut's memories were prodigious. He could call up the street maps of Paris in 1921, could download every photograph or drawing or painting ever done of Proust, could look at the Vermeer that caused Proust's character to faint, could cross-check every character in the books with every real human being Proust had known, But none of this helped that much in Monmouth's understanding of the work. Human art, Monmouth knew, simply transcended human beings. Four secret paths to the truth of the puzzle of life, Orfu had said. The first, Proust's character's obsession with nobility, with aristocracy, with the upper echelons of society, was obviously a dead end. Monmouth did not have to wade through 3,000 pages of dinner parties the way Proust's protagonist had in order to realize this. The second, the idea of love as the key to life's puzzle, this fascinated Monmouth. Certainly Proust, like Shakespeare, but in a completely different way, had attempted to explore all facets of human love, heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, familial, collegial, interpersonal, as well as love of places and things and of life itself. And Monmouth had to agree with Orfu's analysis that Proust had rejected love as a true line to deeper understanding. The third path for Marcel had been art, art and music. But while that had led Marcel to beauty, it had not led to truth. What is the fourth path? And if that failed for Proust's heroes, what was the true path under and behind the pages, unknown to the characters but perhaps glimpsed by Proust himself? All Monmouth had to do, to find out, was open the line to Orfu. Lost in their own thoughts, perhaps, the two friends had communicated very little during this last day of deceleration. "He'll tell me later," thought Monmouth, "and perhaps by then I'll see it myself, and see if it connects to Shakespeare's analysis of what lies beyond love." Certainly the bard had all but rejected sentimental and romantic and physical love by the end of the sonnets. The fusion engines stopped firing. The release from high G and hull-transmitted noise and vibration was almost terrifying. Immediately, the spherical fuel engine spheres were jettisoned, small rockets carrying them away from the ship's trajectory.
"Releasing sail and solenoid," came Orfu's voice on the common line.
Monmouth watched on various hull video feeds as these components were ejected into space. Monmouth went back to the forward video. Mars was clearly visible now, only 18 million kilometers ahead and below them. Repo provided trajectory overlays on the image. Their approach looked perfect. Small internal ion thrusters were continuing to slow the ship and preparing to inject it into a polar orbit. "No records of radar or other sensor tracking during our descent," said Chorus 3. "No attempt at interception." Monmouth thought that the Ganymedean had great dignity, but also a propensity for stating the obvious.
"We're getting data through our passive sensors," said Repo.
Monmouth checked the readouts. If they had been approaching, say, Europa, the displays would have shown radio, gravitonic, microwave, and a host of other technology-related emissions coming from the Moravec-inhabited moon. Mars showed nothing. But the terraformed world was certainly inhabited. Already the bow-mounted telescope was able to pick up images of the white houses on Mons Olympus, the straight and curved slashes of roads, the stone heads lining the shore of the northern sea, and even some glimpses of individual movement and activity, but no radio traffic, no microwave relays, none of the electromagnetic signature of a technological civilization. Monmouth remembered the phrase that Repo had used, "idiot savants." "Prepare to enter Mars orbit in 16 hours, announced Koras. "We will observe from orbit for another 24 hours. Monmouth, prepare your submersible for a deorbit burn 30 hours from now." "Yes," said Monmouth over the common line, stifling the urge to add a sir. Mars seemed quiet enough for most of the 24 hours they were in polar orbit around it. There were artificial things in Stickney Crater on Phobos, mining machinery, what was left of a magnetic accelerator, broken habitation domes and robotic rovers, but they were cold and dusty and pockmarked and more than 3 millennia old. Whoever had terraformed Mars in the past century had nothing to do with the ancient artifacts on the inner moon. Monmouth had seen images of Mars when it was the red planet, although he always thought it more orange than red, but it was reddish-orange no longer. Coming in over the North Pole, the telescopic view resolving things down to a meter in length, what was left of the polar ice cap, just a squiggle of water ice now, all the CO2 having long since been sublimed away in the terraforming, a white island in the blue northern sea. Spirals of clouds moved across the ocean that covered more than half of the northern hemisphere. The highlands were still orangish, and most of the land masses were brown, but the startling green of forests and fields were visible without using the telescope. No one and nothing challenged the ship, no radio calls, no search or acquisition radar, no tight beam or laser or modulated neutrino queries. As the tense minutes moved into long hours of silence, the four Moravecs watched the views and prepared for the descent of the Dark Lady. There was obviously life on Mars, human or post-human life, from the looks of it, along with at least one other species, the Stonehead Movers, possibly human, but short and green in the telescope photos. White-sailed ships moved along the northern coastline and up the water-filled canyons of Valles Marineris, but not many ships. A few more sails were visible on the cratered sea that had been Hellas Basin. There were obvious signs of habitation on Olympus Mons, and at least one high-tech people-mover stairway or escalator along the flanks of that volcano, and photographs of half a dozen flying machines near the summit caldera of Olympus, and a few glimpses of a few other white houses and terraced gardens on the high slopes of the Tharsis volcanoes, Ascresis Mons, Pavonis Mons, and Arcia Mons. But no signs whatsoever of an extensive planetary civilization. Koros III announced over the common line that he estimated no more than 3,000 of the pale, human-looking people lived on the four volcanoes, with perhaps 20,000 of the green workers congregated in tent cities along the shorelines. Most of Mars was empty, terraformed but empty.
"Hardly a danger to all sentient life forms in the solar system, then, is it?" asked Orful Vile.
It was Repo who responded, "Look at the planet through quantum mapping."
"My God," Manmut said aloud to his empty Enviro crash.
Mars was a blinding red blaze of quantum shift activity, with flow lines converging on the major volcano Olympus Mons.
"Could the few flying vehicles be causing this quantum havoc?" asked Orfu. "They don't register on the electromagnetic spectrum, and they certainly aren't chemically propelled."
"No," said Koros III. "While the few flying machines move in and out of the quantum flux, they are not generating it, or at least not the primary source."
Manmut looked at the bizarre quantum map overlay another minute before venturing a suggestion he'd been thinking about for days.
"Would it make sense to contact them via radio or another medium? Or just land openly on Olympus Mons to come as friends rather than spies?" "We have considered this course of action," said Koros, "but the quantum activity is so intense that we find it imperative to gather more information before revealing ourselves."
"Gather information and get these weapons of mass destruction as close to that volcano as possible," Monmouth thought with some bitterness. He had never wanted to be a soldier. Moravecs were not designed to fight, and the thought of killing sentient beings warred with programming as old as his species. Nonetheless, Monmouth prepared the Dark Lady for descent. He put the submersible on internal power and separated all life support umbilicals from the ship, remaining connected only through the comm cables that would be severed when they moved out of the hold. The submersible had been wrapped in ultra-stealth, and a reaction pack of thrusters now girdled the bow and stern of the sub. But these would be controlled by Koros III during the entry phase, then jettisoned. The final add-on was the blister circle of parachutes that would slow their fall after re-entry. These would also be controlled and jettisoned by Koros III. Only after they reached the ocean would Manmut guide his own submersible.
"Preparing to come down to the submersible," called Koros III from the control deck.
"Permission to board granted," replied Manmut, although their titular commander had not asked for permission. He was not European and did not know the protocols. Manmut saw the warning that the ship's bay doors were opening,
exposing the Dark Lady to space again so that Koras could make the transfer by guide cable. Monmouth flicked on the video feed from the hull where Orfu nestled. The Ionian noticed the attention.
"Goodbye for a while, my friend," said Orfu. "We'll meet again."
"I hope so," said Monmouth. He opened the submersible's lower airlock and prepared to blow the last comm cables.
"Wait," said Ripa. "Coming around the limb of the planet."
Control room video showed Koras III dogging the airlock hatch he had just opened and returning to the instruments. Monmouth removed his finger from the button arming the comm line pyrotechnics. Something was coming around the edge of Mars. Currently it was just a radar blip. The forward telescope gimbaled to acquire it.
"It must have launched from Olympus when we were out of line of sight," said Orfu.
"Hailing it now," said Ripo.
Monmouth monitored the frequencies as their ship began calling. The blip did not answer.
"Do you see this?" said Koras III.
Monmouth did. The object was less than 2 meters long, an open chariot sans horses, and surrounded by a gleaming force field. There were two humanoids in the open vehicle, a man and a woman, the female apparently steering it and the taller male just standing there, staring straight ahead as if he could see the stealth-wrapped ship some 8,000 kilometers away. The woman was tall and regal and blonde. The man had short gray hair and a white beard.
Orfu rumbled his laugh on the common line. "It looks like pictures of God," he said. "I don't know who his girlfriend is."
As if hearing this insult, the gray-bearded man raised his arm. The video input flared and died the same instant Monmouth was thrown against the restraints of his high-G couch. He felt the ship shudder twice terribly, and then begin tumbling wildly, centrifugal forces throwing Monmouth hard to the right, then up, then to the left. "Is everyone all right?" he screamed on the all-line. "Can you hear me?" For several tumbling seconds, the only response was silence and line noise. Then Orfu's calm voice came through the snarl of static.
"I can hear you, my friend."
"Are you all right? Is the ship all right? Did we fire on them?"
"I'm damaged and blinded," said Orfu as the static hissed and crackled. "But I saw what happened before the blast blinded me. We didn't fire on them, but the ship is half gone, Monmouth."
"Half gone?" Monmouth repeated stupidly. "What?"
"Some sort of energy lance. The control room, Koras and Ripo, gone. Vaporized. All the bow, gone. The upper hull is slagged. The ship is tumbling about twice per second and beginning to break up. My own carapace has been breached. My reaction jets are gone. Most of my manipulators are gone. I'm losing power and shell integrity. Get the submersible away from the ship. Hurry."
"I don't know how," called Monmouth. "Koras had the control package. I don't know."
Suddenly the ship lurched again and the comm and video lines were severed completely. Monmouth could hear a violent hissing through the hull and realized that it was the ship boiling away around him. He switched on the submersible's own cameras and saw only plasma glow everywhere. The Dark Lady began tumbling and twisting more wildly, although whether with the dying ship or by itself, Monmouth could not tell. He activated more cameras, the submersible's underwater thrusters, and the damage control system. Half the systems were out or slow to respond.
"Orfu?"
No response. Monmouth activated the omnidirectional masers, attempting a tight beam lock.
"Orfu?"
No response. The tumbling intensified. The Dark Lady's hold, pressurized for Koras' arrival, suddenly lost all of its atmosphere, spinning the submersible more wildly.
"I'm coming for you, Orfu," called Monmouth.
He blew the inner airlock door and slapped his restraint straps off. Behind him somewhere, either in the ship tearing itself apart, or in the Dark Lady herself, something exploded and slammed Monmouth violently against the control panel, and then down into darkness. 13. The Dry Valley. In the morning, after a good breakfast prepared by Demon's mother's servitors at her Paris Crater apartments, Ada and Harmon and Hannah and Demon faxed to the site of the last burning man. The fax node was lighted, of course, but outside the circular pavilion, It was deep night, and the wind howl was audible even through the semi-permeable force field. Harmon turned to Demon. This was the code I had, 2186. Does it seem right to you? It's a fax note, Pavilion, whined the younger man. They all look alike, plus it's dark outside. And it's empty here now. How am I supposed to tell if it's the same as some place I visited 18 months ago, in daylight, with a mob of other people? The code sounds sort of right, said Hannah. I was following other people, but I remember that the Burning Man node had a high number, not one I'd ever faxed to before. And you were what? Sneered Demon. 17 at the time? A little older, said Hannah. Her voice was cool. Where Demon was mostly pale flab, Hannah showed tanned muscle, as if recognizing that disparity, even though Demon had never heard of two human beings physically fighting outside the turncloth drama. He took a step backward. Ada ignored the prickly conversation and walked to the edge of the pavilion, putting her slim fingers against the force field. It rippled and bent, but did not give way. "This is solid," she said. "We can't get out." "Nonsense," said Harmon. He joined her, and the two pushed and prodded, leaned their weight against the elastic but ultimately unyielding energy shield. It wasn't semi-permeable after all, or at least not to physical objects like human beings. "I've never heard of this," said Hannah, joining them to put her shoulder against the invisible wall. "What sense does it make to have a force field in a fax pavilion?" "We're trapped," said Demon, eyes rolling like rats. "Moron," said Hannah. The two did not appear to be getting along well today. "You can always fax out. The portal's right there behind you, and it's still working." As if to prove Hannah's point, two spherical general-use servitors came through the shimmering fax portal and floated toward the humans. "This field is keeping us in," Ada said to the servitors. "Yes, Ada, said one of the machines. "We regret the delay in getting here to help you. This fax node is rarely used." "So what?" said Harmon, crossing his arms and scowling at the lead servitor. The other sphere had moved off to float near one of the supply cubbies in the pavilion's white column. "Since when are fax nodes sealed off?" continued Harmon. "My apologies again, Harmoner," said the servitor in the almost male voice used by all general-purpose servitors everywhere. "The climate outside is inhospitable in the extreme at this time of year. Were you to venture out without thermskins, your chances of survival would be low." The second servitor extracted 4 thermskins from the cubby and floated past the 4 humans, offering the less-than-paper-thin molecular suits to each person in turn. Demon held the suit in 2 hands and looked puzzled. "Is this a joke?" "No," said Harmon. "I've worn one before." "So have I," said Hannah. Demon unfurled the thermskin. It was like holding smoke. "This won't fit on over my clothes." "It's not supposed to," said Harmon. "It has to go next to the skin. There's a hood on it as well, but you'll be able to see and hear through it." "Can we wear our regular clothes over it?" asked Ada. There was a hint of concern in her voice. After her useless exhibitionism the night before, she was not feeling very adventurous, at least not when it came to nudity. The first servitor answered, "Except for footwear, it is not advisable to wear other layers, Ada Ur. For the therm skin to be effective, it must be fully osmotic. Other clothes reduce its efficiency." "You have to be kidding," said Demon. "We could always fax back home and get our coldest weather clothing," said Harmon. "Although I'm not sure that it would be up to the conditions outside here." He glanced at the shimmering force field wall. The howling wind was still quite audible and frightening beyond it. "Now," said the second servitor, "standard jackets and coats and capes would not be adequate here in the dry valley. We can manufacture more modest extreme weather clothing and return with it within the next 30 minutes if you prefer." "Hell with it," said Ada. "I want to see what's out there." She walked to the center of the pavilion behind the fax portal itself and began disrobing in plain view. Hannah took 5 steps and joined her, peeling off her tunic and silken balloon trousers. Demon goggled a moment. Harmon walked over to the younger man, touched his arm, and led him to the far side of the circle where he began undressing as well. Yet even as he disrobed, Demon glanced over his shoulder several times at the women. Ada's skin glowing rich and full in the light from the overhead halogens. Hannah, lean and strong and brown. Hannah glanced up from tugging the therm skin up her legs and scowled at Demon. He looked away quickly. When the four stood in the center of the pavilion again, wearing only their shoes or boots over the therm skins, Ada laughed. "These things are more revealing than if we were naked," she said. Demon shuffled with embarrassment at the truth of the statement, but Harmon smiled through his mask. The therm skin was more paint than clothing. "Why are we different colors?" asked Demon. Ada was bright yellow, Hannah orange, Harmon a brilliant blue, Demon green. "To identify each other easily," answered the servitor, as if the question had been directed to it. Ada laughed again, that free, easy, unself-conscious laugh that made both of the men glance at her. "Sorry," she said. "It's just that it's pretty obvious, even from a distance, which of us is which." Harmon walked to the force field and set his blue hand against it. "Can we pass now?" he asked the servitors. The machines did not answer, but the force shield wavered slightly. Harmon's hand passed through it, and then his blue body appeared to be moving through a silver waterfall as he stepped through. The servitors followed the four into the windy darkness. "We don't need your escort," Harmon said to the machines. Demon noticed that the other man's voice was lost in the wind, but he could hear clearly through the thermskin cowl. There was some sort of transmission device and earphones in the molecular suit. "I apologize, Harmon Ur," said the first servitor, "but you do, for the light." Both servitors were illuminating the rough ground with multiple flashlight beams from their shells. Harmon shook his head. "I've used these thermskins before in the high mountains and far north. They have light enhancement devices in the cowl lenses." He touched his temple, feeling around for a second. "There. I can see perfectly well now. The stars are brilliant." "Oh, my," said Ada as her night vision switched on. Rather than the small circles of light afforded by the servitor's flash beams, the entire dry valley was now visible, each rock and boulder glowing brightly. When she looked up, the blazing stars took her breath away. When she turned her head, the lighted Faxnode pavilion was a glowing, roaring furnace of light. Their therm skins glowed in color. "This is so wonderful," said Hannah. She walked 20 paces away from the group, jumping from rock to rock. They were at the bottom of a wide, rocky valley with gradual cliffs on either side. Above them, snowfields glowed bright blue-white in the starlight, but the valley itself was all but free from snow. Clouds moved in front of the stars like phosphorescent sheep. The wind howled around them, buffeting them even when they stood still. "I'm cold," said Demon. The pudgy young man was shifting from foot to foot. He had worn only walking slippers. "You may return to the pavilion and leave us," Harmon said to the servitors. "With all due respect, Harmonur, our person protection programming does not allow us to leave you here alone to run the risk of injury or getting lost in the dry valley," said one of the servitors. "But we shall retreat 100 yards if that is your preference." "That's our preference," said Harmon. "And turn off those damned lights. They're too bright in our night vision lenses." Both servitors complied, floating back toward the Faxnode pavilion. Hannah led them across the valley. There were no trees, no grass, no signs of life whatsoever outside of the four human beings glowing in bright color. "What are we hunting for?" asked Hannah, stepping over what might have been a small stream in summer, if indeed summer ever came to this place. "Is this the site of the Burning Man?" asked Harmon. Demon and Hannah both looked around. Finally Demon spoke. "It could be, but there were, you know, tents and pavilions and restrooms and flow domes and the force field over the valley and big heaters and the Burning Man and daylight, and it was different then. Not so cold." He hopped gingerly from foot to foot. "Hannah," said Demon, "I'm not sure. That place was also rocky and desolate, but Demon's right, it looked different with the thousands of people and sunlight. I don't know." Ada took the lead. "Let's fan out and hunt for some sign that the Burning Man was held here. Campfires, rock cairns, something. Although, I don't think we'll find your wandering Jew person here tonight, Harmon." "Shh," said Harmon, glancing over his blue shoulder at the distant servitors, then realizing that they were broadcasting their conversation anyway. All right, he said with a sigh. Let's spread out, say, a couple of 100 feet apart, and look for anything that... He stopped as a large, only vaguely humanoid shape appeared from a side canyon. The creature picked its way across the rocks with a familiar, awkward grace. When it got within 30 feet, Harmon said, "Go back, we don't need a Voynix here." One of the servitors answered, its voice in their ears, even though the sphere itself floated far behind them. "We must insist, my gentlemen and ladies. This is the most remote and hostile of all known fax nodes. We cannot risk the small chance that something here could harm you." "Are there dinosaurs?" asked Demon, his voice on edge. Ada laughed again and opened her arms and hands to the dark and howling cold. "I doubt it, Demon. They'd have to be some tough, recombinant winter breed I've never heard of." "Anything's possible," Hannah said, pointing to a large rock near the entrance to another side canyon, about 50 yards to their right. "That could be an Allosaurus right there, just waiting for us." Demon took a step back and almost tripped over a rock. "There aren't any dinosaurs here," said Harmon. "I don't think there's any living thing here. It's too damned cold. If you doubt me, lift your cowls for a second." The others did. The molecular earphones rang with their exclamations. "You stay back unless called," Harmon directed the Voynix. The creature moved back 30 paces. They walked up the valley northwest according to their palm direction finders. The stars shook from the force of the wind, and occasionally all four of them would have to huddle in the shelter of a large boulder to keep from getting blown over. When the gale lessened in intensity, they spread out again. "There's something here," came Ada's voice. The others hurried to join the yellow form 100 feet to their south. Ada was looking down at what at first appeared to be just another rock, but as Demon got closer, he saw the brittle hair or fur, the odd flipper appendages and the black holes or eyes. The thing appeared to be carved from weathered wood. "It's a seal," said Harmon. "What's that?" asked Hannah, kneeling to touch the still figure. "An aquatic mammal. I've seen them near coastlines, away from fax nodes." He also knelt and touched the animal's corpse. "This thing's dried out, mummified is the word. It may have been here for centuries. Millennia." "So we're near a coast," said Ada. "Not necessarily," said Harmon, standing and looking around. "Hey," said Demon, "I remember that big boulder. The beer pavilion was pitched just below it." He made his way slowly to the boulder near the cliff wall. "Are you sure?" asked Ada when they'd caught up. There was only the rock slab rising toward the coldly burning stars and hurrying clouds. Everyone looked on the ground for signs of the tent or campfires or carryall tracks, but there was nothing. "It was a year and a half ago," said Harmon. "The servitors probably cleaned up well and..." "Oh, my God," interrupted Hannah. They all turned quickly. The orange-suited young woman was looking skyward. They lifted their heads even as they each noticed the play of colored light on the rocks around them. The night sky was alive with curtains of shimmering, dancing light, bars of blues and yellows and dancing reds. "What is it?" whispered Ada. "I don't know," Harmon responded, also whispering. The light continued to writhe across the uncloudy portions of the sky. Harmon lifted off his thermskin cowl. "My God, it's almost as brilliant without the night vision. I think I saw something like this once decades ago when I was..." "Servitors," interrupted Demon, "what is this light?" "A form of atmospheric phenomenon associated with charged particles from the sun interacting with Earth's electromagnetic field," came the voice from the distant machine. "We no longer have the particulars of the scientific explanation, but it goes under different names, including..." "All right," said Harmon, "that's enough. Hey." He had pulled on his cowl again and was looking at the rock slab in front of them. There were complex scratchings on the rock. They did not look as if they had been made by the wind or other natural causes. "What is it?" asked Ada. "It doesn't look like the symbols in the books." "No," agreed Harmon. "Something from the Burning Man?" said Hannah. "I don't remember scratches on the rock near the beer tent," said Demon. but maybe the servitors scratched up the surface moving some of the stuff out after the celebration.
Perhaps, said Harmon.
Should we keep hunting around here? Asked Ada. Try to find some sign that this woman you're after was here, or even that the burning man was here? Maybe there are some ashes left.
In this wind? Laughed Demon. After a year and a half?
A pit, said Ada. A campfire. We could...
No, said Harmon. We're not going to find anything here.
Let's fax somewhere warm and get some lunch.
Ada turned her yellow head to look at Harmon, but she said nothing. The two servitors had floated toward them, and the Voynichs loomed just behind them.
We're going, Harmon told the closer servitor. You can use your flashlight beams to illuminate our way back to the fax pavilion.
It was just after midday in Ulaanbaat, and the usual 100 or so guests were milling at Toby's ongoing second 20 party on the 79th floor of the Circles to Heaven. The hanging gardens rustled and sighed from the breeze blowing off the red desert. Demon was greeted by a host of young men and women who had not noticed his absence over the past few days, but he followed Harmon, Hannah, and Ada as they found hot finger food at the long banquet table and had cold wine poured by a servitor. Harmon led them away from the crowd to a stone table near the low wall at the edge of the circle. 800 feet below, camel caravans driven by servitors and followed by Voynichs padded in on the hard-packed Gobi Highway.
What is it? Said Ada as they sat in the garden shade and ate.
I know something happened back there.
Harmon started to speak, paused, and waited for a servitor to float past.
Do you ever wonder, he asked, if that utility servitor is the same one you just saw somewhere else? They all look alike.
That's absurd, said Demon. Between bites on a chicken leg, he was licking his fingers and sipping his chilled wine.
Perhaps, said Harmon.
What did you see back there in the dark? Asked Hannah. Those scratches on the rock?
They were numbers, said Harmon.
Demon laughed. No, they weren't. I know numbers. We all know numbers. Those weren't numbers.
They were numbers written out in words.
It didn't look like the jiggles in books, said Ada. Words.
No, said Harmon. I think was the kind of writing people used to do by hand. The words were all loopy and connected and worn down some by the wind. I suspect that they were written there way back at the last burning man, but I could read them.
Words, laughed Demon. A minute ago you said they were numbers.
What did they say? Asked Hannah.
Harmon looked around him again. 8849, he said softly.
Ada shook her head. It sounds like a fax note code, but it's way too high.
I've never heard of a code that started with 2 8s.
There aren't any, said Demon.
Harmon shrugged, maybe, but when we're done here, I'm going to try it out at the core node here.
End of side 4.